may proceed.
May it please the court, Chris Chandeville for the Commonwealth as the appellant in this appeal. I'd like to reserve about 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
You like about 3 minutes or 3 minutes?
I will shoot for exactly 3 minutes, Your Honor.
All right.
This appeal is before this court because the Court of Appeals erred in reversing Ms. Lambert's conviction by ignoring multiple alternative findings made by the trial court, by its application, by the Court of Appeals application of the single required showing contained in the statute, which was error, by injecting a fourth standalone factor into the statute, which does not constitute a standalone factor, and then finally by misconstruing the trial court's findings and analysis. Virginia's assault and battery statute, which is contained in 18.2-57, contains an affirmative defense for school employees or teachers or other employees of a school who can make three separate required showings. The first is that the employee, and this is under subsection G, little I, the first is that the employee or teacher was acting within the course and scope of her official capacity. The second is that she was engaged in incidental, minor, or reasonable physical contact with the victim. And the third is that those physical contacts were designed to maintain order and control. In order to benefit from this defense, the defendant must make each of those three required showings, as the way that the statute reads. The trial court found that the defendant did not make any of those three required showings, that the evidence did not support any of the three required showings, and thus held that she was not entitled to that defense and convicted. The Court of Appeals, in its analysis, focused on one of those three required showings and held that because the trial court had, according to the Court of Appeals, erred in its analysis as to one, the entire conviction had to be reversed. That conclusion was error because the Court of Appeals failed to consider the trial court's alternative findings as to those other two required showings, which the trial court found had not been met. Each of those two required showings by itself is standalone sufficient to support the trial court's conclusion that the defense did not apply.
May I ask you this?
Yes, sir.
You may be right on that, but I'm questioning whether or not subsection G really is an affirmative defense, the way you put it. The language is assault or assault and battery shall not be construed to include ... That's not really the language of an affirmative defense. That's really a definitional restructuring of the Commonwealth's burden. I mean, so it's just odd. I'm questioning, is it truly an affirmative defense, as you say it is, or is it simply, for purposes of one application, retooling the elements of the crime, which would mean the burden of proof always remains on the Commonwealth?
Yes, Your Honor. So two responses to Your Honor's question. First of all, regardless of whether this court construes it as an affirmative defense or an element of the defense that the Commonwealth is required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, I do believe if that latter is the case, the Commonwealth met its burden beyond a reasonable doubt with the evidence that was put forth. Reaching the substance of Your Honor's question, though, under the Court of Appeals analysis in Mayhew versus Commonwealth and the standard enunciated there for what is an affirmative defense, I think three of the factors that are enunciated there are applicable here. One is the reviewing court is supposed to ask whether or not the so-called defense or element that is at issue was necessary to complete the prohibition that the General Assembly intended. The second is whether or not it creates an excuse or a justification for what would otherwise be criminal conduct. And the third is who is in the best position to know the facts that are at issue in putting forth that defense. I think all three of those support the conclusion that it is an affirmative defense because it is not necessary to create an exception for school teachers in order to prohibit an assault and battery. It does create an excuse or a justification for what would otherwise be criminal conduct. This unwanted touching would be criminal conduct, but for this excuse or justification that's included in the statute. And finally, the defendant is often going to be in the best position to know the facts. So you would be requiring, to read it as an element of the defense, you'd be requiring the Commonwealth essentially to prove a negative, to prove that there was no way Lambert might have had some justifiable reason that may have been only known to her for disciplining this child. And so for that additional reason, that burden should fall to Lambert, to the defendant in a case such as this. But again, as I began that response, under either standard, I think the Commonwealth has met its burden.
We have to sort of parse this case out in sections in order to actually analyze it properly. Tell me why the Court of Appeals is not at least correct in holding that Code Section 18257G1, whatever it is, an affirmative defense or definitional aspect, cannot be trumped by the Scott County School Board standards of conduct or a disciplinary letter.
I think as a general matter, that statement is absolutely correct. Nothing that the General Assembly does can be trumped by any local school board. However, whereas here the General Assembly delegates some room for an approach that is not a one-size-fits-all approach. I think what the General Assembly did here was they said, we are concerned and care about what authority has been delegated by a school board or by other authorities who are by law in a position to delegate such authority to the teachers and school employees at issue. So by choosing the language, whether or not she was acting within the course and scope of her official capacity, that is the General Assembly indicating that we are not endorsing a one-size-fits-all approach here, that you have to look at what are the facts on the ground, what authority has been delegated within the scope and course of this employee's official capacity, and was that employee exercising that delegated authority.
The problem is it seems to be contradictory. If she's a teacher, she's entitled to whatever protections that 18.257G1, a little I, provides. If she's entitled to those protections and she still is a teacher or someone covered under that statute, what effect can the Scott County School Board standards of conduct or a disciplinary letter do to change that unless they change her classification to bring her outside the statute?
I think there's an important distinction between whether or not she had an official capacity and whether or not she was exercising an official capacity on the one hand, and on the other hand, whether or not she was acting within the scope of that official capacity. So no, the local school board cannot change the protections granted by the General Assembly, but when the General Assembly indicates that the protections we're going to give to you are governed by the scope of your official capacity, you have to ask, who defines the scope of that official capacity? In each individual case, it's going to be a school board under the Virginia Code that defines what the scope of that official capacity is. So I would submit that this is evidence that could be relied upon appropriately in applying the General Assembly, the language used in the statute, that there was no trumping anything that the General Assembly did created by statute when the General Assembly intentionally created a standard that would require fact finders to look to the local governing bodies.
Well, let me follow that up. If that's correct, then you could conceivably have, I mean, there's thousands of school teachers and personnel in school systems. If that's correct, you could have a different standard in 1,000 different cases.
And if,
is that workable?
If the General Assembly decides that that's what it intends to do, I think that courts are bound by the legislative intent. And I think that there's good reason why the General Assembly might intend to do that, because the General Assembly might say, you know, we are not school teachers, we are not school administrators, we are not principals. And so for each individual school, for each individual population of students, when you're dealing with special needs students as opposed to high school students, as opposed to elementary school students, there may be different standards of what is permissible conduct and what is permissible physical contact with a child, depending on the situation, depending on the facts on the ground, depending on the type of population being served. And so what the General Assembly did here is they decided we're not going to create a one-size-fits-all approach. We're going to create an approach that does factor in what kind of authority has been delegated.
But you know, the concept course and scope of employment is not unique to the statute. It's in the workers' comp statute. It's in vicarious liability tort principles. It's in innumerable federal statutes that impose liability, FELA, et cetera. So it's not simply, how you're allowed to do things. It's the tasks that you're given to do. So as a general proposition, course and scope would not be, oh, you didn't do it the way I told you to do it. It would simply be, did you do the task? Yes. Well, you did it poorly. Okay, it's within the scope of my employment, but I did it poorly. So that's the line that the Chief's drawing with you, and it's got to be correct, because we would change the whole concept of course and scope if we applied that level of detail that you're applying to it.
I understand the Court's concerns. I do think there can be a distinction between scope of employment and scope of an official capacity, and that the policy interests could be different depending on which statute is being applied, and the policy interests here are stronger. However, with the court's permission, I'd prefer to spend
time. Yeah, you should move on because that doesn't necessarily end your case.
It does not end the case. And I do think that the narrowest and best grounds, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
I do think the narrowest and best grounds for resolving this case, which the Court of Appeals completely ignored, is whether or not Ms. Lambert engaged in incidental, minor, or reasonable physical contact with this child.
Hold just one minute. I think Justice Lacy wants to ask you a question about what you're about to leave.
Well, I really wanted to follow up with Chief Justice Lemon's first question, which is you do agree, and also I'll begin my question with that. Or do you agree, however, with the Court of Appeals' determination or its interpretation of the statute, that in applying the statute, a court must first consider and give due deference to reasonable judgments? In other words, the court must decide whether or not a judgment of a teacher was reasonable. And do you agree with that interpretation of the statute by the Court of Appeals?
I would agree with that interpretation to a point. I think as you read the statute, that paragraph at the end that talks about giving due deference to reasonable judgments made at the time of the event, is the way the statute actually reads. I've quoted the statute at page 12 of my brief. In determining whether a person was acting within the exceptions provided in the subsection. So in other words, in doing the above analysis, are these contacts reasonable, incidental, minor, which is within the course and scope of authority, etc. In doing that analysis, courts are required to give due deference to reasonable judgment. So it's a gloss on the rest of the analysis that has already been enunciated in the statute.
In other words, you're saying that the trial court could determine that particular action taken by a teacher was not incidental, etc., prior to making the determination of whether or not the reasonable judgments at the time of the teacher or officer were the judgments were reasonable.
No, I think that analysis has to occur at the same time. So for a fact finder, in determining whether or not the contacts were incidental, minor, or reasonable, that analysis has to be viewed through the lens of giving due deference to reasonable judgments made at the time.
But my question, though, is whether or not the reasonableness has to be determined with regard to the perception of the events, not just what the action was taken, but the perception of the events itself. Because it says reasonable judgments.
Reasonable judgments made at the time of the event. So, yes, there is room for considering what judgments were made by the individual and whether those judgments were reasonable. And with the Court of Appeals, this is the final part of the Court of Appeals analysis where the court erred again. I see them in my rebuttal, so I'll finish.
Well, you have 2 minutes and 24 seconds left. You can use it any way you'd like, but you've got a lot of other ground to cover.
Yes, Your Honor. I will end by saying that the Court of Appeals misconstrued what the trial court did in that context, because the Court of Appeals assumed that Ms. Lambert's judgment was correct about the level of disobedience and found that it was an unreasonable response to even the alleged level of disobedience. For that reason, the conviction should have been affirmed.
May it please the Chief Justice and Justice of this court, I think we can address some of those issues. They talk about, let's just start. It's quite my honor to represent Heather Lambert. Let's look at the section 18257. I agree with the comment made earlier that this is not an affirmative defense. It says specifically simple assault, and I apologize, I'm fighting a cough, and I'm eating cough drops like crazy, so I apologize to you. I've already taken liquid cough medicine too to try and quell it. Shall not be construed to include the use of any teacher shall not be construed to include. Doesn't say that you can use this as a defense. It's a definition. And so the burden is on the Commonwealth at that point in time. And whether it's a tough burden or not, it's immaterial. Because the legislature wrote it the way they wrote it. And it's to be given its plain meaning. And it says what it says. So they have to start with the proposition that she's a teacher. We have no dispute about that. In the course or scope of her official capacity, she was acting as a teacher. Whether she violated school policy or something they had told her, and that would be an offense for which she could be terminated, is not the issue here. The issue here is whether she should be convicted of a criminal charge. We look at incidental, minor, or reasonable physical contact. Look at what happened here. You have before you, in the record, the video of what Mrs. Lambert did. Unlike many cases where you have to just read a record and conjecture what happened, you can see.
Well, counsel, does the video cover the entire, doesn't it also include inside the school in which it's not covered?
It does.
So we really don't know everything that happened from the video.
But it is indicative of what happened. I think you see the majority of what happened. You don't see every single thing, no.
But does it, are you asking us to ignore the testimony of the other witnesses?
I'm not asking the court to ignore. Even if what they say is true, I don't believe she violated this statute. Because what is the evidence? The evidence is this young lady may have had a small mark on her wrist. That's it. If you look at other statutes involved in this...
Then you're asking us to set... you're saying that the trial court erred in holding that it was not incidental.
Yes,
it's ma'am. As a matter of fact.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
But
the Court of Appeals did not hold that.
Well, they didn't address that, but this court can. And if you look at 863.2.15.11, these three statutes that...
Can I interrupt you for a second? But the Court of Appeals held not that, as a matter of law, no reasonable jurist or jury could conclude that this was anything other than minor, incidental, or reasonable. What they said was the trial court used the wrong legal standard by not applying the deferential gloss paragraph to that factor and remanded it for trial. That was the holding of the Court of Appeals. But there was no cross appeal or cross error by you to say, no, that didn't go far enough. They should have flat out vacated the indictment.
That's correct, Judge. But
so we have no authority to go as far as you want us to go in this case, even if we were to agree with your argument.
Okay. I'm not arguing that point, Judge. Let me argue that their holding is accurate, though, because shall not include physical pain or minor injury is included in 63.2.15.11, which we cited numerous times in our briefs. If the court goes on, what was Mrs. Lambert's situation here? She was faced with making an immediate decision. This child leaves something, whatever it is, a special needs child, at the school bus stop. The child is not being... We all know special needs children need discipline. They need consistency. And she had a split decision to make a decision whether or not to go get that child or not.
Well, counsel, I don't want to interrupt you, but following up on the prior question, the Court of Appeals held that the trial court erred not in finding that her decision was wrong, because it did not consider whether, from her perspective, it was reasonable. So whether we think her decision was right or wrong based on the facts is immaterial, isn't it? Aren't we simply faced with the concept of whether or not the trial court should have viewed it from a reasonable decision-making perspective?
That is correct, may it please the court. But that's, I think, looking at that, that's going to be an impossible burden for the Commonwealth to meet in this case. I don't think they can.
But is that the issue before us?
If this court simply affirms what the Court of Appeals did and remands it, we're satisfied with that decision. And we're satisfied with that.
Well, then let me ask you this. The Commonwealth claims in this case that the trial court's decision was based on more than one reason. And one of the reasons was that the trial court said, even if everything that Ms. Lambert said was true and happened the way she said it, the trial court still said, nevertheless, the action that she took was unreasonable and it was not incidental, etc. So the Court of Appeals didn't seem to address that. isn't that, as the Commonwealth argues, an alternative holding of the trial court, which was ignored by the Court of Appeals?
I don't believe it is, may it please the court. I believe that if you apply due deference to this in looking at the scope of her appointment, and they did not give her due deference, I think that's the same thing.
But isn't the trial court statement that says, even if I accept, basically I'm saying I accept everything she said as true, the response was not incidental, etc.?
And I think that's contrary to the Court of Appeals findings. I think if we're at the point where that court said she was not, they used the wrong standard, and then we think that's still correct. If I'm not answering the court's question.
Well, we have already discussed that the standard that they said the trial court did not use was applying a reasonableness test to her view of what happened. And the trial court also said, even if I accept everything she said as true. Now, isn't that applying a reasonableness test to her events as to what happened and giving her due deference as to her judgment as to what happened that led to her response? Doesn't that give her due deference?
I don't believe it does, Judge, and under the ends of justice, I don't think that's what the court is looking at there. I don't believe that that gives her due deference.
Okay.
The part of this case is interesting because the trial court never really determined whether the judgment the teacher was reasonable. They determined that it was mistaken in the perception. And they are not mutually exclusive. I mean, you can have a reasonable mistake. And if that's the case, it seems to me that the remand for a new trial would at least address what is the issue in the case, assuming that, and I'm not speaking for my colleagues, but assuming that the code section is a criminal code section. It's not going to be modified by Scott County Board of School Board or their standards of conduct. Out of the picture, it seems to me that this case still has a gaping hole in it. Because in order to show her deference, you have to show that her understanding of the events was reasonable. Not that she was mistaken, but that her understanding of the events were, unreasonable. So isn't what you have asked for exactly what ought to be done? Send
yes,
it back for a new trial?
I agree. I do, Judge. Judge, we've discussed a lot of things here. I encourage the court to look. This case that was cited by the Commonwealth, the Pleasants case, is one that I submit. The quote in there is very telling. When the protest, I submit this case supports our position, not that of the Commonwealth. When the protest demonstration became unduly disruptive of the educational process and due order and discipline in the school, it became not only the right but the duty of the principal to take reasonable measures to restore order so the educational process might continue. That's exactly what this teacher did in this case in microcosm. She wasn't dealing with a bunch of students, but she was dealing with one student. She was dealing with one student that she was acting in good faith to try to get that student a teaching moment. It's interesting that the teacher's aide said, I would eventually have done exactly what this teacher did. But to do it an hour later is not the teaching moment. The teaching moment has to happen then, particularly with special needs children. And she went back in. I started to quote the court a minute ago, the other statute. And even minor injury is not included under an abuse and neglect, under the abuse and neglect statute pertaining to teachers. And if in a civil case where you cannot find somebody guilty of abuse and neglect for minor injuries, certainly a criminal statute is even more so. The ruling in the Pleasants case is consistent with what we've asked for here. we would ask the court to affirm what the Court of Appeals did and remand this case for a new trial.
All right. Thank you very much. You have 2 minutes and 14 seconds left. Let me focus on what, at least what I think is the challenge before us. If we decide that the criminal statute can't be modified by the school board, that's a shorthand way of getting rid of that one. We have this dilemma. I looked at the videotape. I'm confident that at least some, if not all, of my colleagues did as well. Immediately, you have this dilemma. We defer to the factual determinations of trial courts. We might not have made the same decision, but we nonetheless defer. But we don't do it if they didn't use the right standard in order to reach that determination. And that's what I think is the problem in the case, and that's what the Court of Appeals focused on. And they said, in the instant case, the trial court did not provide due deference to the appellant because it found the appellant was mistaken in her belief. The trial court didn't determine whether the appellant's understanding of the events was nonetheless reasonable. Now, that's the heart of this case as far as I'm concerned. I can't speak for my colleagues. Will you respond to that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Regardless of whether or not the trial court made that determination, was the mistake reasonable or not, that is not determinative of the outcome of this appeal. I'll tell the court why. The trial court went much further than the Court of Appeals says it should have gone. The trial court first said, you know, I really don't believe the testimony of the defendant because in light of these other credible witnesses who testified, but even accepting her statement as true, even if this alleged disobedience had occurred, so not just did she make a reasonable mistake, the trial judge said, I'm assuming she was correct. I'm assuming she made no mistake. And on page 252 of the appendix, the trial court held, even assuming that alleged disobedience occurred, this was an unreasonable response to the alleged level of disobedience. So if the response was still not incidental, not minor, and not reasonable, and she cannot benefit from that defense, regardless of whether or not her perception of events was reasonable.
It's your position that the Court of Appeals erred in its characterization of what the trial court decided.
Correct, Your Honor. I believe that's my third assignment of error. The Court of Appeals stated that the trial court ended its analysis prematurely, but the Court of Appeals ended its consideration of the trial court's analysis prematurely. Unless there are any further questions from the court, I'll rest in my brief, ask the court to reverse the Court of Appeals opinion and reinstate Ms. Lambert's conviction.
Thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Oh.